Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and episode 4 of the Fantasy Production Meeting, where we build the productions we want to see as a down payment to the future. We are...
Liza in London, and I am true and tragic about love.
Alexandra in the UK, and tragically lacking in dramatic backdrop, unlike everyone else.
And I'm Robert in Lavenham, and I'm true and tragic about muffins. We are the Fantasy Production Team, and this is our meeting. Today we're looking at the true tragedy of Richard III from the repertoire of the Queen's Men, dated to somewhere around the early 1590s, but dating and company do not worry us here. We do not care. We are only interested in how we might want to produce this play today, now, in this instant. To help us decide which version we would like to pursue, we have a special guest. A special guest who we will try to impress and win over to our side. To build the illusion of jeopardy, the winning pitcher gets... Drumroll, please. I may insert a sound effect in later. To choose the next play we look at on the next episode of the Fantasy Production Meeting. Yes, I know, all the great stuff, and that play hasn't already been pre-chosen and organised in some sort of cunning lie that sometimes these things come up with. So, in not exactly the hot seat, more the moderately warm, going on toasty seat today is...
Hi, I'm Tamara, and I'm wearing very fiery glasses. I've just realised that's quite fitting.
For the listeners at home, yes, Tamara does indeed have a pair of spectacles on the nose and hooked around the ears. I'm just trying to paint a visual picture for you there. If you're inspired by our ideas or would like to help keep us in cheese, then you can support our work generally on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, where you can hear the uncut version of this episode. You can hear it early. You can even, depending on which tier you pledge from, you can even watch the video of us doing all of this stuff. There's nothing actually particularly exciting about the visual dimension of what we're doing here, but you can watch it. You can watch us move. There's a host of other patron-only content and early access stuff available too. But that's enough of that. Let's get down to business. We've got productions to build.
But Robert, what's the play about?
I'm glad you asked that question. Now, if you're a subscriber to our YouTube channel, you might have seen that we've done two read-throughs of this play already, The True Tragedy of Richard III, one of which featured some acting. But for those who haven't seen those videos, here's a brief recap of the action.
Richard III. What's it all about?
Well, truth and poetry sets the scene. The Duke of Clarence is dead and appears as a ghost.
Ooh.
Which sets the scene. Heir King Edward IV dies, and Richard is generally nudged by his servants to take the throne from the new, very young King Ed V.
Meanwhile,
the dead king's lover, Jane Shore, is a tad worried about her position and what it's going to be in the New World Order.
Meanwhile,
Richard starts clearing the decks of rivals, arranging for the arrest of Hastings via his trusty servant, Paige.
Who has no name.
Richard clears the other rivals and takes the throne. Jane Shore is cruelly thrust onto the streets without recourse to public kindness.
You cannot rely on the kindness of strangers.
And now King Richard gets the two princes killed, following a murder brainstorming session by the various murderers.
Who do have names.
Oh yes, the murderers, Will Slaughter and Jack Denton.
Then
Buckingham, largely absent in the play, rebels and dies.
Then
Richard starts to lose his grip on his kingdom and himself.
Then
Richmond turns up and has to try and get Stanley on his side, but Stanley's son has been held captive by Richard.
And then
the Battle of Bosworth happens, Richard dies, and the page,
who has no name,
is left as the only mourner of his life. Richmond has won, history is recited, and
everyone lives happily ever after.
The end. So it's a history play that makes a whole series of amazing choices about how to tell this story. Basically, I love this play. So, how to produce it? So we're going to now go to the Fantasy Production Meeting whiteboard, and we're going to crack on pitching some ideas. So, first, general question for each in the room. What budget, venue, Which media are you thinking of using? It could be theatre, it could be video, it could be audio, it could be any other kind of artifact in the world. So what is your production going to be about? How are you going to make it happen? High concepts allowed. I will go to Liza first.
Okay, well, this is a fantasy production meeting. So in terms of budget, we have as much as we need, including anything for emergencies. Okay, what I'm seeing is a warehouse space where we can do something of a promenade production that leads the audience into and through the world of the play. Because this, in this play, the characters are all so human, and we're going to keep coming back to this as a theme, but the characters are all, even though this play goes incredibly hard and a lot of people are incredibly extra at times, I would quite like for the characters to be, you know, up close and personal with the audience, or as up close and personal as they wish to be, safety regulations, etc. But yeah, I want the audience to be in the street with Shore's wife, to be outside the inn with the dubious innkeeper. I want the audience to be recruited by Richard or by Richmond at Bosworth. So that's my thought. I'm seeing, yeah, a warehouse venue. I'm seeing as much firelight as we can get away with. This is fantasy, but I still don't want to kill anyone. So in a safe kind of way, if I can have torches, if I can have like braziers that are enclosed in some way so nobody actually sets themselves on fire, I would love that. Yeah, just something about the smell of damp concrete really resonates for me with this play.
Smell of damp concrete there from Liza. Alexandra, are you sticking with theatre? Are you jumping to a different medium? Have you got different ideas?
I would also like it to be live performance. I think there is something to this play that definitely benefits from being in your space in real time. Like Liza, I would like an environment that I can create, that I can utilize the basic fabric of and the various features, architectural features, to create a whole variety of environments in the story. I would want to use something like an old church, such as, for instance, in Leicester, perhaps a cathedral of a sort. It doesn't have to be that specifically, but that kind of look where you could have, you know, a scene that is in front of a great big rose window, and you can have a different scene that's surrounded by stone, and you can have, you know, sort of wall hangings and whatnot to represent indoor spaces. It's really important to my space that we have a number of levels and of sort of different positions, relative positions to the audience who would be static, but the idea of using a bit of set dressing and especially lighting and sound, you would need everyone on microphones because it's probably a very echoey space if it's a church or an old castle or something, but using lights and sounds, or using a lot of technology to kind of help transform these environments so that you look one way and you're watching people indoors in a domestic environment, and then you look another way and you're watching them on the road, for example. Yeah, that's me.
So we have two live events. One's leaning towards a more warehouse aesthetic for this history play. One going for a more church cathedral. I think go for cathedral. We have the budget. Tamara, so far, which of these are you leaning towards anyone yet?
I am intrigued by both. Obviously, the warehouse space and the idea of promenade, or even, dare I say, something that's slightly immersive is obviously something that's really popular now as well, or it used to be. But the idea of a cathedral, mostly because I'm from Sussex and I used to sing in a school choir, and I can picture it. So,
So there's a hint there, Liza. Lean towards the immersive as we go on.
Well, for sure. Or one could very well combine these two ideas and do a site-specific site at a, you know, a ruined castle, or as Alexandra says, a cathedral. It's a lot easier to get permission to do things that are a bit unholy in a castle than in a cathedral.
Worry not about this. Do we have fantasy budgets, we have fantasy fixers who can sort anything. It's not a problem.
We can be immersive. We can have a giant butt of Momsy and just, you know, immerse them.
Yeah, especially as Clarence does turn up quite teed off at the very beginning of the play. So absolutely, that's definitely one way of getting the drinks round to the audience as they first come in. Drinks served by Clarence as a really, really teed off bartender. I think that's a very, very reasonable shout. Okay, I'm, for once, not going to choose theatre. I don't normally do this. I'm not even going to choose audio, which is my usual thing. I'm actually going to go for film. I'm really interested in the Brechtian aspects of this. So if I was doing theatre, I would be leaning very heavily into the choices that characters make in this play. People keep making choices. So the reason I want to go for film is actually those moments where people can just turn to the camera. And they can go straight into the camera and they can just say, what do I do? And it's one of these semi-repeated refrains. Who were I best to offend is a line that turns up. And that choice, like magical spotlight moment, the camera goes straight into close up on the faces. And I'm seeing this as something that's a very modern dress. Something that's trying to speak very actively to people today, and really trying to get to the heart of that, just playing with the individuals in the play. That's not even so much focusing on Richard, because Richard does have soliloquies and does have a relationship with the people at home. But actually, that's not the important one. Everybody has a relationship with the audience. And that's what I'm really keen on. I say using the frame of a television screen or a film screen to really just look the audience or the audience in the eye and say, you know, this is a choice that has to be made now. What choice would you make? This is the choice I'm making. And I think film actually allows us to do slightly more with that, with this text, than perhaps theatre does as well. Actually, some of those moments might not land as well in theatre as they might. So I'm hoping that that's something that's going to lean into. So having heard the three pitches, Tamara, are you leaning in any particular direction?
Well, you've obviously made it extra hard for me because film is my medium. Obviously, House of Cards comes to mind, but then a big part of me had this sudden idea of, could you get away with a faux documentary, a little bit like what we do in The Shadows, but not comedy? Would that work? Could you use the same sort of device, but make it not a comedy because it's a tragedy? I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by that. But live performance is live performance. And, you're making it really hard. You're making it really hard. I need to hear more.
You need to hear more, which is lucky because that's what's coming up next. But before we go into our specific pitches, we're going to pitch a scene in just a moment. We're going to go to Sarah Blake, who has recorded for us a cocktail. Hello, Sarah.
Hello to you.
And so now we're moving away from our very serious discussion of what we would do with the true tragedy of Richard III, and now we are going over to something a little more light-hearted, as we are going into the world of Cocktail Minute, our house cocktail shaker, as it were, cocktail shaker and maker. Sarah Blake has created for us a bespoke cocktail that describes an element of this production for you to go away and inebriate yourself at home in association with this play. So I'm going to pass you over now to Sarah and Cocktail Minute.
Legal disclaimer.
We accept no liability as to how this drink affects your internal organs or views on the nature of reality.
All recipes are followed at the listener's own risk. Don't have nightmares.
And now, over to Sarah and Cocktail Minute.
Richard III. He's not a nice man. He kills a lot of people. The first person he kills in this play, or at least the first victim of his that we meet, is actually already dead. And it's his brother Clarence. We meet him right at the beginning of the play, and he's in ghost form. So, to commemorate his untimely end, this is a cocktail called the Ghost of Clarence. Now, as we know, Clarence was drowned in a butt of wine. So you begin this cocktail with red wine. And you want a kind of quite a soft, fruity wine. You don't want anything that's got powerful or robust or spicy on the label. There's something like a nice Merlot, or I've got here a red Riesling. And you want 45 mils of that. Put that into a cocktail shaker, and then you want to add 35 mils of slow gin. Now, this is a homemade one, vintage 2007, so this is the good stuff. But you can buy slow gin just, you know, in the supermarket. Put that in your cocktail shaker too, and then add some fresh lemon juice. You want about 5 mils lemon juice. Depends on how sweet your slow gin is, because it does vary from brand to brand, but about 5 mils. Stick that in your cocktail shaker, then take your trusty bar spoon and add 1 bar spoon of elderflower syrup. And this will give it a lovely kind of floral edge. Once all that's in your cocktail shaker, you then add the secret ingredients. Now, normally I tell you to shake your cocktails over ice, but with this, what I'd like you to do is shake it over frozen blackberries. The frozen blackberries will perform exactly the same function as the ice in that they'll, you know, make the drink nice and chilled, but they will also add just a little bit of blackberry flavor. So give that a shake with your frozen blackberries, and then tip out the cocktail into a martini glass, and you'll end up with something that's suitably dark red and bloody looking. And then what you'll find is that shaking the liquid over the berries will have just thawed them enough that you can get a cocktail stick through them. So then put a couple of berries onto the end of a little cocktail or barbecue stick so that they kind of look like Clarence. You know, we've got his body here and his head, so that's Clarence. And then you can just go, oh, bye Clarence. Oh, and give him a stir. Make sure he's completely dead. And then, you know, either right now or more likely when you've actually finished the drink, you can pull him out again. And there he is. The Ghost of Clarence. Vindictor.
That was Cocktail Minute with Sarah Blake. Soupy twist. So it is now time for us to pitch a scene. We have a few minutes each to pitch a scene that we're really keen on from the play. We're not necessarily going through the play chronologically, and hopefully this will give the audience at home a little taster of what some of these scenes are all about. But I'm going to go to Alexandra first.
No, what? No, no, what? No. Okay.
I was looking at your eyes, looking to see who was the most unprepared, and I thought I'd swoop in on you because I want to win.
Okay. Cheater. So, shall I go for it?
Yes, yes. tell us, Alexandra, about your scene or scenes, sequence of scenes will allow that you are excited. Is it some scenes from the beginning, the middle, or the end? Where do your scenes live?
My scene is in the middle, is not perfectly at the centre of the play, but quite middle placed. And it is a scene that I find very interesting and quite pivotal to what you were talking about earlier, Robert, of characters making choices and characters developing and evolving as a consequence of those choices. So the page, which is one of my favorite characters in this play, comes on and says, his very first line is, "Why thus by keeping company am I become like unto those with whom I keep company?" He's been Richard's page for this entire play, and he has witnessed Richard's rise. He's been a bit worried about it. And he's found himself in a position now where he wants power too. The scene then has Richard and Catesby and Hastings come along. With the support of Catesby, Richard arrests Hastings. And by the end of the scene, Richard is left alone with the page and says to him, "Well, look, there's one more thing that is really important that I need to get done." And the page asks Richard to trust him with this information. Richard does. It is that he wants the princes killed. as it were, the rightful king, the son of the previous king, and his younger brother. And the page brings up the character of James Tyrrell, who is famously the murderer, the organizer of the murders. And the scene ends with Richard saying to the page, this is very good of you. I'm going to remember this. So it's a massive evolution in what happens to the character of the page, but also to what happens to Richard in his turn against Hastings, in his decision to trust the page with this horrific thing. And in terms of what is happening to the country, what we can infer is happening to the country overall. So with my staging, given that I've got an entire great big cathedral to play with this, it would be really interesting if this contrasts with some earlier, more kind of public scenes. There are some scenes that are supposedly happen outdoors or in the view of a lot of people, where this can be very small and claustrophobic in those bits of interaction. And because people are on microphones, they can, of course, speak very low and yet be heard by everyone in the audience. So there's not that need, that outdoor theater need, to project your innermost thoughts, which I think would lend itself quite nicely in general to a lot of naturalistic performance. Also, I think the way in which this scene fits in the play allows for somewhere near it, perhaps with moving some scenes around, the interval. And so you would, I think, almost end on a cliffhanger of whether or not, you know, this plan is going to go well. So it sits structurally in an interesting place. It's very interesting what happens through it. And I think it would be very important to kind of emphasize that in the immediacy of the changes in the characters through the directing. And yes, I think that's a pivotal scene from the middle that I would love to explore.
Lovely. I will come in next with my thoughts on scene. I'm gonna mention a scene and do an honourable mention. So I'm gonna talk about the very very beginning of the play, which is a slightly tricky scene to get right, but I think really leans into the idea of turning this into a film, because we have at the beginning of the play this introduction by poetry and truth. And in terms of what the play means by poetry, it's basically dramatization. There is the true story, and then there is the film that we are making. Leaning very much into Tamara's thoughts on, you know, that this could be done in a semi-documentary style, that those moments of going into people's speeches could actually be, you know, framed as separate interviews that could have been done in a rather than a dramatic moment where lights change and everyone zooms in. It actually cuts away to talking about the thing that might have happened to them earlier. So the setup at the beginning of this question between truth and poetry could almost be like a script meeting between a historian and the filmmaker. And so you can actually almost see the filmmaker popping up throughout this, and that there's the architecture of making a film becomes part of what's going on. I mentioned that in passing to actually talk about the scene that I really, really, really want to talk about, which is the scene with the old innkeeper and Richard's page. You know, as a scene that you can actually really get your teeth into. So Richard's page, the page who has no name, who saunters through this like an every person figure, who is both on Richard's side and is not necessarily a good agent, but also is engaged with what everybody else is doing, and this host. And he's basically trying to say to the host, give me the keys. We're going to do horrible things to Hastings. Let us get on with that. Here is some money for your time. And the host has this wonderful moment where he just turns, and in ours, it'll be turns to the camera. Alas, what shall I do? Who are I best to offend? Shall I betray that a good old earl that have lain in my house this 40 years? Why, an I do, he will hang me. Nay, then, on the other side, if I should not do as my Lord Protector commands, he will chop off my head. But is there no remedy? He's got this impossible choice whether he's going to do horrible things to a nice person or kowtow to someone in power. And I think that's what talks to the whole thesis of this play, or at least how I see it anyway. The text does move in different directions, but that this is a play about, not about some overarching villainous evil doer who takes power. It's about the people who enable him to take power. And I really want to focus on all those individual characters and their journeys, as well as Richard, without getting too drawn into those things. And I think that scene with the old innkeeper and Richard's page is just so, so addresses that so well, and it's addressed in so many other scenes that we will talk collectively of in just a moment. But yes, that's my pitch of something that switches between a relatively naturalistic performance to then a more documentary aside with the architecture of documentary there, seen from the beginning of the play and early on in the play. Tamara, are you being swayed in any direction at the moment? And our survey says,
It's very hard because both pitches that I've heard, and I'm sure the third one will be the same, are very, very different things. So it's really hard to be swayed. And at the moment, I'd quite like to see both. I mean, logistically speaking, I'd be fascinated to see how in a script you would basically turn poetry and truth into, say, the director and his cameraman. And at the same time, if the audience is static in the cathedral, and then you have maybe for the scene that Alexandra talked about, you have that scene quite in an enclosed space or something, but it's still visible. Again, that can be very, very interesting. Again, like I said before, it's just very different things. It's very different vibes, and I want to see them all at the moment.
Well, I suppose it is a fantasy production, so you could have all the fantasy productions. I don't think the budget is limited, but you do need to make a choice at the end. Oh, is there a follow-up from Alexandra?
Yes. Besides the fact that you can, in a big space, you can always achieve a small space with lighting, I wanted to support a point of Robert's, actually. There is not only the truth and poetry at the beginning, but there is a third character called Report who turns up near the end and basically takes the page's interview as to how the battle went, who died, and what happened.
Yes, and that there could be a doubling simpatico there with the question of truth. You know, the truth, the historical, the historian's perspective, and poetry, the dramatist's perspective. And when do they agree and when do they disagree? Because there's all sorts of, you know, we have so many. It's a can of worms about the question of what is true and what is not in this particular period of history. It would be reasonable to say that some people have taken sides on the whole question of was Richard a nice chap. Liza, you've got food for thought there. I believe you're looking at things, scenes more towards the end of the play.
I am, and I was going to talk about another page-centric scene, but now I think I'm going to pivot. We've talked about the page a lot. I love the page, but I think I've found the scene that sells the play, and it's nearly at the end. It is bracketed by two absolute balls out incredible speeches by Richard. Okay, so Richard has become king. We're on the eve of Bosworth. I think we're waking up the morning of Bosworth. And Richard, we start with Richard alone with the audience. And okay, this is a fantasy production. Right now we can't do this safely. But at a time when we can, I do want this to take place in quite a claustrophobic space. I want people packed in, like butt to butt and belly to belly. And I also want there to be a sense of they can't escape, which obviously in a promenade production, you need to leave people somewhere to escape in case they need to. Again, safety concerns. But yeah, I want people trapped in the room with Richard confiding in them, because his psychological breakdown that began, that he built for himself, and it began when he became king, when he got what he thought he wanted. So he gives this whole speech alone with the audience about how he knows the entire world wants revenge on him. And there are something like 10 lines, very nearly in succession, that all end with the word revenge. It's an astonishing speech. At this point, he knows that his friends are leaving him. He has taken Lord Stanley's son, George, hostage in order to secure Stanley's loyalty. But Lovell and Catesby then appear after this speech, and they speak in a very weird way. For a play in which many people talk just like humans talk, Lovell and Catesby in this scene, especially Lovell, speaks kind of like a ghost. Or like a magician, you know, speaking a sort of elegy over the king, who is perfectly healthy right now, but whose reign is in its twilight. And they use rhyme, which is not that common in this play. Richard suddenly, weirdly, goes into tetrameter. The bad rebellion of my foe is not so much as for to see my friends do fly in flocks from me. Lovell before that prompts him with, sour is his sweet that favors thy delight. Great is his power that threats thy overthrow. Lovell switches wildly between giving Richard hope and taking away that hope. So it's clear Lovell is wavering. Catesby comes in with the news that Stanley will not bring his power to join Richard. He knows what will happen to his son, and he's accepted the consequences. And Richard then orders the son's execution, and Catesby and Lovell do their very best to persuade him not to do it. Richard then, in desperation, says, Lovell, Catesby, let's join lovingly and devoutly together, and I will divide my whole kingdom amongst you. Which is, again, very strange. But then again, we are shown, in this play, we are not shown Richard with a spouse or a child. And by the time of Bosworth, he'd lost both in history.
We're going to move on to, very briefly, I'm going to give us a couple of minutes to talk about this. Now, there was a scene we all agreed that we might want to just mention or talk through, which is the two scenes with Jane Shore. Now, we have done a workshop on this. It is available on YouTube as an additional bit of content about, it's all about Jane Shore, who is the Dead King's mistress and is left high and dry. And initially, we have a scene where she is worrying about what's going to happen to her next. And then we see the scene where we see what happens to her next, when Richard basically turns on her and goes for her. So within the framework of what you'd like to do on stage with this scene, do you have anything that you want to throw in at this time? I'll go to Alexandra, then Liza.
So the idea that she starts off is something I haven't mentioned, which is that but you can infer it, that my production with all this kind of historical setting would also have historical costumes. So I like the idea that she would start off with the riches that she had, getting this bit of news about the king's death and realizing, oh God, I'm going to have to give up on these things. And then as the play progresses, we might occasionally see her either crossing through the audience or kind of, you know, appearing before or just after a scene if it's set in a public place, so that we don't forget who she is. But so maybe that's once in between the two scenes. And then we see her in this scene where she is destitute and people are treating her like dirt, which we make a very brightly lit, very large space, very public area, and everyone in the cast is going past her. Everyone is ignoring her after she has gone through the audience, or while she is in amongst the audience, so that we get very much the idea that as the audience you are complicit in this.
Yeah, I really like the complicity. So for my thinking is that we're playing around still with who's filming what, because in the second scene when we see her and she's on the street, nobody is allowed to give her any kind of relief. No one's allowed to give her money or help her in any way, and everyone is looking over their shoulder as to who's watching. So the question of who's holding the camera at that point is really important, and who's watching it. So it's a matter that maybe the cameras are distanced, and the moment they turn up, so the cameras at that point might actually belong to the page and the propaganda. So the feed that this film is assembled from might not all be from one documentary crew. It might come from different sources, so that we have official Richard propaganda. We might even have Richmond propaganda mixed in with an independent filmmaker as well. So it creates a whole series of conflicts about who can film what dialogue when. And we've got, again, so many options in that second scene. And even the first scene. The first scene could be more official interviews going on of going, I'm really worried about what's going to happen next. You know, all my friends, I'm hoping they're going to stay with me. And of course, they'll be going, yeah, sure, and all that stuff. And then they don't. That's my minute up. Liza, 1 minute on Jane Shore.
Stage has an advantage over film here, because in a stage play, you can watch the whole scene. You can watch everyone on stage, whereas film tends to focus on individuals and small groups. So there's a marked difference between how people behave towards Shore's wife when they think they're not being watched, as in they're only being watched by us, the audience, or when they are being watched, that is, the page comes in, who they know works for Richard. And in fact, one person, Morton, is about to give Shore's wife some help. He says, my store is but small, yet as it is, we'll part stakes. But soft, I cannot do what I would. I'm watched. We get that, and I absolutely agree with Alexandra's point about audience complicity, but I feel that in a promenade production, that complicity could even be greater, that you can have Shore's wife in among the audience, just desperate for help. The characters in the world of the play have been forbidden to help her by Richard. The audience is forbidden to help her by theatrical convention. We are complicit. We can't help her. We are forbidden from helping her. And when the page comes on stage to mock her, the page is essentially us.
And if you do that interactively, what's wonderful is you can have people in character stopping people who are audience from... Yeah, that's wonderful. Also, I just wanted to flag up, we've been referring to her as Shore's wife because that's how she's written in the dramatis personae, not because that's our opinion.
Yes, they never mention her name Jane. They do talk to her as Mistress Shore in the actual dialogue, though that changes depending on whether she's in the room or not. Anyway, we need to briefly move on. Tamara, keep you thinking. There's a little more to come that may sway you. We'll come back to you in just a moment. And now a little interlude as we enter the chat room. Enter the chat room. We've already looked at this wonderful play twice on YouTube in our various exploring sessions, where we use the chat room to enter into the deeper world of the play and look for the more intellectual aspects that we can share and celebrate with you now. And so, as we enter the chat room, we're going to find out what the deepest and most intelligent thinkers of the world think about this play as they read it. So now, join us as we enter the chat room.
It was a lovely death.
I'm going to reboot the Wi-Fi.
Love the Queen's cat.
I have rough envy. Lol.
Parcel delivery.
I brought a plot point, but you were out.
Lol, whoa there.
I just realised my Mandarin made a guest appearance.
Exfoliate the kingdom.
Can we punch the page?
What's happening?
Don't look him in the eyes.
Parking lot, here I come.
The rough returns.
Scenery will be chewed at every opportunity.
And that was the important message from the chat room. I'm sure that was very helpful for all of you at home. We'll now leave the chat room and return you to your regular content. We now have a very brief wild card question round where anyone in the room can just pitch in additional thoughts about their production. Do you have any rehearsal process in mind? Are there any script changes or cuts that you want to look at? Are there any issues with the play? Early modern players have a tendency to have specific issues that need to be addressed, tweaked or played around with. Any of those? Liza, I'll go to you first.
We've just had... a very good question come up in the chat about what are our thoughts about music in our fantasy production. And now, going back to what Alexander said about historical costumes and a historical setting, there's a choice to be made about historical costumes in this play. Do we costume it when it was written, or do we costume it when it's set? And I would love to go not beautiful medieval, but like rough and scratchy medieval. I would love to include some medieval music because to a modern ear, our modern concept of key, of tonality, had not yet been developed in the medieval era. And so medieval music sounds really rough and really primal to our ears. I think it would set the scene just right for this play.
Especially if you're doing it in a medieval space where medieval music or, you know, music of that era is more frequently sung or chanted for, you know, other purposes.
Yeah, stepping in on that idea. Alexandra, you have 1 minute to talk about any issues that you have.
It's not an issue. I think it's a great opportunity for casting. As always, my default in casting is global majority and gender free. But we now know for a fact, since the excavation of the corpse in a parking lot, that Richard III did indeed have, as was reported of him in contemporary accounts, a scoliotic defamation of the spine. And I find that this play makes no mention of that. And that is why I would like it to be cast. It is very important to me that that is the one bit of historical accuracy that we would cast intentionally. So finding somebody, and there are a plenitude of actors who have a physical appropriateness, let us say, for this part, and then make no mention of it and not make a thing of that in the world of the story, because humans are human, and they come in different shapes, and it makes no difference to who they are as a character and to how he evolves as a character. But I think it would be, that's why I think it would be so valuable to include this as not a and gimmickry, but as a sort of nod to the fact that all humans are human. And this one historically was. An additional point on that, the play has, I believe, unless I've miscounted, 4 female characters. So again, that's something that I would be interested in balancing out in casting.
Yeah, I just want to address that, Alexandra. The text does mention disability and various disabilities for Richard within the text about 3 times. It does not, however, and I think that's one of the really important things about this text, is it doesn't necessarily make it a character assessment. It is not a reason for any of the motivations that he's doing. It is not that he is some monster that is being guided by malice from his physicality from birth. It is just a fact. He does utilize the withered arm that is referenced, but he only uses that as an extension of the thought of historical narrative that the playwright at the time was utilizing. But it's again, that's utilized as a ploy by Richard himself. So,
and that is to do with witchcraft, with a claim of witchcraft. That is, I think it's in the chronicle that the author was using for inspiration, that moment, that episode. So you could do that as a temporary sort of, you know, I have been injured by witchcraft, as opposed to, you know, using it as a general reasoning for the having of a disabled character.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
In this play, Richard's appearance, his physical divergence, shall we say, is referred to a very small number of times. And as Robert said, his appearance is not linked to his character. We don't get physical disability equals evil as heavy-handedly as we well might. I like the lack of ableism in this text.
Right, we now, as we're approached going to Tamara, any moment now, we have our last chance saloon to try and pull Tamara around to our side. So are there any, and this is just generally for a bit of fun, we ask, are there any favourite lines, any favourite speeches, any favourite scenes, any favourite characters that we love, that we might have something to do? And do we have an elevator pitch that we can just, win one line, pitch to Tamara? Do we have an idea what we might want to put on the poster as quotes? I've already said a few of them. Who were I best to offend? It's just I like that something. There are some lovely lines in this. So many of the lines are really lovely in context. They're not necessarily brilliant poetry lines. They are really good dramatic feeds for something else. I like, if villain feeds thou me with ifs and ands, but I don't know what to do with that necessarily. I also quite like as a line to just conjure with, sirs, you that be resolute, follow me. The rest go hang yourselves. Which is I do feel I want to be able to use in day-to-day life. Yes, does anyone have any favourites that they just want to conjure with and just have fun with? And do you have an elevator pitch? Liza, do you have an elevator pitch?
I do. My elevator pitch is basically the end of that speech, which Rob just stole my fave. He just quoted the last 2 lines of that speech. But I'm coming for revenge, because I'm going to quote like the last 4 or 5 lines. This is my elevator pitch. You're a theatrical executive with all the cash in the world. Again, fantasy. We're talking the end of the Muppet movie here. Yet death, sweet death, my latest friend hath sworn to make a bargain for my lasting fame. And this, I this very day, I hope with this lame hand of mine to rake out that hateful heart of Richmond. And when I have it, to eat it, panting hot with salt, and drink his blood lukewarm, though I be sure 'twill poison me. Sirs, you that be resolute, follow me. The rest, go hang yourselves. I want that to be said to a promenade audience, directly to them in a small space, and see what happens.
Alexandra, any elevator pitch or favorite bits?
I don't have an elevator pitch, but I do have the last line of the movie trailer, which is Richard and Buckingham have just had an entire scene where they've announced and arranged what's going to happen to the young princes. And so they've set the world to rights, and the scene ends with Buckingham very publicly saying something like, sound trumpets, God save the king. And then Richard has only his name that he says immediately afterwards. So we have this moment of build drop. So the trailer ends, God save the king! Richard. Blackout. That's me. Also, I really love, besides the fact that we haven't mentioned enough how amazingly written Richard's speeches are and what a wonderful sort of character construction he has, I love the fact that he has a moment of redemption or sort of redeeming himself in his own eyes near the end, and that he is redeemed in the page's speech, which comes, so in the page's eyes, as it were, which I think is a very nice kind of up and down sort of journey. But before all of that, Richard has, even before he's become king, when he's just revealing to us that he really, really wants to be one, he has this brilliant speech that ends in, if I be but king for a year, nay, but half a year, nay, a month, a week, 3 days, one day, or half a day, nay, an hour, zounds, half an hour, nay, sweet fortune, clap but the crown on my head, that the vassals may but once say, God save King Richard's life, it is enough.
Okay, I'm seeing a poster. I'm seeing a poster. Richard III, valiantly minded, but tyrannous in authority. That's where I'm going with that. Alternatively, for the trailer, I think a trailer is important, especially, you know, obviously doing a film. You know, wilt thou do it, or wilt thou betray me? But sadly, we are well out of time. We're slightly overrunning, only slightly. Tamara, you've heard all the pitches. You could ignore all the other voices. You can ignore everybody else. Just listen to my voice. Go for my pitch. You can ignore whoever, what anyone's saying in the chat. Where do you want to go?
So, I think if I didn't have to pick one, I would say, Let's combine Liza's and Alexandra's ideas, and let's make the film as well. But I have to pick.
Yes, you do. That's the format. That's the format. Okay, it's a cruel world. It's cruel.
Before you make your final choice, I have to emphasize that I've got a very cute cat right here.
Tamara has cats of her own.
However, I am rapt audience, which, you know, audience on audience who is audio only, you are missing quality content.
Yeah, there's a cat quality on screen. So anyway, Tamara, back to that difficult, unfair choice that I'm making you make.
Yeah, quite. I am going to say, I'm really sorry, but as much as I really want us to write this script, I'm not seeing the film without intense massaging of the text.
Well, that's one down.
And I'm saying that in the full knowledge that I will never be allowed back in as the guest judge ever again.
Nonsense. Your impartiality recommends you for the job.
Yeah, after all this tyrannous hinting that's been going on, which I felt was very appropriate to this play, you have made somehow the correct choice.
I have very sweaty hands because of that. No, I really want to. Part of me is saying, Robert, let's go and write this script, but a big part of me is also saying, I think we're going to have to massage the text a little bit. Whereas, with the two live performance productions, and this is why I said I'd love to combine both of them. Having grown up in Chichester, I'm really familiar with that cathedral, and I would love a space like that as an immersive promenade type play. So this is why I am gonna choose Liza's, because it's immersive, and I love immersive, and also I miss immersive, because viruses and pandemics and plagues. So, I'm going with the immersive, but I am going to ask Liza to consider maybe doing it in a castle or, you know, catacombs or a cathedral.
Yes.
Just a cathedral.
You know, I am at my happiest and most joyful among old buildings and especially among ruins. This sounds great. Alexandra, what say we co-direct this?
We can
tour various cathedrals, but we would have to tailor the production to each in a site-specific way. But, you know, we could tour,
fantasy. With tomorrow's money, yes.
This being fantasy, we automatically have all the money we need and everyone's going to get paid really well. And there's also a really nice pub right near every venue we're performing in.
Liza, you have won. You have won the right to choose the next play that we look at in this session. So you get home territory advantage in terms of the play you want us to do next. What play would you like us to do next?
Well, Rob, I think I really have to go for Thomas Cromwell.
That is all we have time for on this particular fantasy production meeting. I'm going to put away the whiteboard and all our notes are going to be carefully archived for the future. If you have ideas about things you'd like to see in the fantasy production, give us a buzz for the future. If you're interested in suggesting plays, suggesting thoughts, suggesting questions, disagreeing entirely with the outcome of this wholly rigged jury, if you want to do any of those things, you can contact us on admin@beyondshakespeare.org or on social media at Beyond Shakes, pretty much all social media that matters. That is the at thing. You can also contribute to what we do on Patreon. There's also a Ko-fi as well. There's all these links in the show notes. You can go to those things. All that remains is to thank Liza, Alexandra and Tamara for being absolutely fabulous today. Thank you very much, everybody, and goodbye.
Bye.
Yet death, sweet death, my latest friend hath sworn to make a bargain for my lasting fame. And this, this very day, I hope with this lame hand of mine to rake out that hateful heart of Richmond, and when I have it, to eat it, panting hot with salt, and drink his blood lukewarm, though I be sure 'twill poison me. Sirs, you that be resolute, follow me. The rest, go hang yourselves.
Richard III, valiantly minded, but tyrannous in authority.
Come read with us. It is fun.